In any account of the development of modern architecture, the work of Walter Gropius, both as architect and educator, must be given a prominent place. Gropius was born in 1883 of a German family which had architectural prowess. His father was a member of the Berlin Building Commission, and his great uncle was a pupil of the distinguished 19th century architect Schinkel. Walter soon decided that he too would become an architect. And when old enough, he entered the technical school in Berlin-Charlottenburg. This school, however, was too conservative for young Gropius, so he left it and entered the Munich Technical School. The education he received in architectural offices was even more to his liking. When he was 21, Gropius built some workmen's houses on his uncle's estate in Pomerania. And in these, one can see the non-historic bent which has consistently characterized his work. These houses are paramountly direct and practically and practical, avoiding all suggestions of fussiness. Honest, symmetrical brick houses, they must have seemed very blunt for the period 1906. This architectural debut was followed by 2 years of travel in Italy, Spain, and England. Then Gropius returned to Germany and entered the office of Peter Behrens. Behrens was the great industrial architect of that time and place, designer of the General Electric turbine generator plant in Berlin, the Mannesmann pipe factory at Düsseldorf, and many other works. Behrens strongly believed that construction must be expressed in architecture, and that construction so expressed would lead to new and unprecedented forms. He was especially conscious of the power resident in simple geometric forms. Undoubtedly, Gropius profited by this association with Behrens. Though in his own architecture, he avoids the sense of mass and weight so prevalent in the work of his one-time master. In 1910, Gropius set up his own office. Learning that a prominent industrialist was planning to build a factory, he interviewed the man and received the commission. The result was the Fegis Buchlast factory at Alfeld an der Leine, then in collaboration with Adolf Meyer. Because this was an industrial project, and because industrial buildings were scarcely considered as architecture at that time, Gropius had a freedom from historic architecture that another type of building might not have given him. The Alfeld factory became an epochal achievement in industrial architecture. Decoration was entirely omitted. Instead, dependence was placed on the building itself and the character of the materials used. Within a regular and rectangular framework, the design is one of variety and unity. The front wall or facade was treated as a great wall of glass, allowing light to flood the interior. One could easily mistake the Fegis factory for a factory of 1935 rather than one of 1910. In the grouping of the buildings with their accompanying chimneys, water tanks, pipes, and cranes, one is definitely conscious of the complexity and drama of 20th century industry. But it is a complexity dominated and brought under control by a master plan which fits each element into its appropriate place. In 1914, Gropius was placed in charge of the industrial section of the Werkbund Exposition at Cologne. For that exposition, he constructed an impressive hall of machinery. For the administrative office of this, he used semicircular, transparent glass stair pavilions. These were in marked contrast with the brick of the center panel, and constituted a very daring and a very novel use of glass for that early date. After the war, Gropius assumed the directorship of the Grand Ducal Art School at Weimar. This was transformed into the famous Bauhaus, a school which became a fountainhead for modern design until it was closed by the Nazi regime in 1933. In that same year, Gropius left Germany, first to live in England and then America. But I want to tell you something of this school, Bauhaus. Gropius invited several modern painters to help him in developing his ideas, such men as the Russian Kandinsky, the Swiss Klee, the German Willy Baumeister, the American Lionel Feininger, and others. In speaking of post-war years and the founding of the Bauhaus, Gropius says, "I saw that an architect cannot hope to realize his ideas unless he can influence the industry of his country sufficiently for a new school of design to arise as a result, and unless that school succeeds in acquiring authoritative significance. I saw, too, that to make this possible would require a whole staff of collaborators and assistants, men who would work not automatically as an orchestra obeys its conductor's baton, but independently, although in close cooperation, to further a common cause. This idea of the fundamental unity underlying all branches of design was my guiding inspiration. End of quotation. In this school, every pupil was bound by legal terms of apprenticeship and registered with the local trades council. Manual instruction was a part of the training, a practical first step in the mastery of industrial processes. After a period of preparatory instruction, consisting of elementary design principles and experiments with different materials, the pupils entered upon the second phase, that of technical instruction. This lasted 3 years and combined practical work in the trades and manufacturing firms with theoretical instruction. At the end of this period, and upon successful execution of an individual design, the pupil received a journeyman certificate of craftsmanship. If proficient enough, he might also present himself at the Bauhaus apprenticeship examination. From this group of qualified apprentices, the best were selected for further training and placed in the research station and designing studio. This last period of training continued the alternation between work on actual buildings and theoretical study. Students were urged to gain practical experience in business and manufacturing and were sent to other technical institutions for work in specialized studies, such as concrete construction, heating, plumbing, mechanics, and so forth. Upon successful completion of all this, and the time varied according to individual circumstances, the pupil was awarded his Master Builder's Diploma. In 1925, the Bauhaus was moved from Weimar to Dessau, and Gropius designed and built the new school and the nearby group of professors' houses. The school building has something of the same appearance as the Ahlfeld factory about it, and properly so, for it has shops as well as classrooms and studios, and in all the rooms, good light was necessary. Long horizontal bands of glass serve this function of lighting the buildings. The plan is soundly developed according to needs. The one building containing a wing of apartments and a wing for the local technical school, in addition to housing the necessary shops, classrooms, and administrative offices. The project received wide publicity. As might be expected, the system of instruction and the nature of the architecture was misunderstood by many. Superficial imitators pirated the architectural forms and by so doing helped to give the Bauhaus and modernism a bad name. We must remember that in modern design, whether in silverware, ceramics, furniture, or architecture, the brilliant designs are freely imitated by men of limited ability. That these imitators often miss the essential core of original beauty goes unnoticed by most people. Original and imitation are lumped together as modern and frequently condemned on the basis of the second-hand or third-hand examples. But in spite of such misunderstanding, the Bauhaus became a very important center. During the next few years, Gropius was increasingly busy with housing projects, one in the suburb of Tirten, at the Darmstadt-Siedlung outside Karlsruhe, and in Berlin. In order to concentrate on these projects and feeling that the Bauhaus was well established, he withdrew from it in 1928. In these housing schemes, such as the Siemensstadt apartments, Gropius usually uses concrete. Their roofs are flat, the windows are grouped in horizontal bands, and individual balconies are frequently provided for each unit. In 1933, Gropius left Germany, and after a brief residence in England, he came to America. In this country, he has done a substantial amount of work, and the volume of it is steadily increasing. Most of his time, however, has been taken up with his duties as head of the design department in the School of Architecture at Harvard University. At Lincoln, Massachusetts, in association with a former Bauhaus assistant, Marcel Breuer, he has built several houses, including one for himself. This is of wood frame construction with clapboard siding. It is set on a hill and it takes full advantage of view, air, and sunshine. The entire south wall is of glass, allowing winter sunshine to enter the living dining room. In summer, however, a projecting eyebrow or ledge screens out the hot rays of the summer sun, while a screened porch which juts out on the south side catches the breeze and provides a delightful place for dining or reading. There is also a terrace on the second floor where one can sunbathe or read in cool shade. Similar features are incorporated into the Breuer and Ford houses nearby. Within the last year, Dr. Gropius and Marcel Breuer have collaborated on a housing project for a suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Known as Aluminum City Terrace, it is located on a hilly, wooded site, and it includes 250 units. The architects were given a wide latitude in the design of this, but since its inception, perhaps because they were given so much freedom, it has been a storm center. This on the basis of politics as well as aesthetics. However, 89% of the tenant families have decided that they like the project, and I think that an exceptional recommendation. From the very beginning, the architects wished to give all the housing units southern orientation and a view. This resulted in a very open and informal arrangement. Most of the units face or back up to the single winding road which threads through the development. Here and there, two or three units are grouped around a cul-de-sac or street pocket. The construction is wood frame, but wood frame used in a somewhat untraditional way. Flat roofs, ribbon windows, and vertical boarding. But what a reaction when they first began to build these. Chicken coops, rabbit hutches, the public called them. After occupancy, 11 out of 25 tenants still disliked the exteriors, although many of these were satisfied with the arrangement and design of the interiors. Of 8 people who had heard the houses called chicken coops before they began to live in them, only 2 believed that that term was still justified after they had lived in them for some time. Part of the criticism of the exteriors was probably due to the fact that the original budget for landscaping was severely cut. Funds have since been made available, however, and the landscaping, I believe, is being installed. The large windows of the houses were generally appreciated by the tenants, although they do not like the sunshades which are built over them to screen them from the hot summer sun. The chief objection to these sunshades is that they drip water when it rains. Other objections were stated, but in thoughtful conversation, what seemed to be objections were often merely objections to something new and something unrelated to the experience of the tenant. All in all, some 21 out of 25 tenants liked living in the project. 3 were uncertain, and only 1 positive in his outspoken dislike. Over many years, Dr. Gropius has been interested in standardization, and this has continued to occupy much of his attention in recent years. But then there's little use in trying to mention his special interests. He views life and architecture as one. He has been a powerful figure in the development of an architecture which is integrated with life. We are fortunate in having him in this country, a leader in one of our foremost architectural schools. I think those of you who heard him speak at the University of Illinois this past winter will agree that he's a most thoughtful man, highly personable, and one from whom many other great contributions can be expected.